You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, a lot going on in the world. We'll give you an update on what's going on with MH17 in a few minutes. Some things have changed over the weekend, but basically, the international community is still not. Still don't have full access to the area that's under the control of these Ukrainian rebels or whatever you want to call them. And Gaza has melted down over the weekend. On the line with us is Ari Wolfiler. He's the development director with Jewish Voice for Peace, Jewish Voice, FORPEACE, JewishVoiceForPeace.org is their website. Ari, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. And first of all, could you, for many of our viewers or listeners who are unfamiliar with JewishVoiceForPeace.org, how do you describe yourself and your organization?
We're a national Jewish organization who believes that the answer to the ongoing violence in Israel and Palestine, and we're of course seeing right now an incredible escalation of that violence, actually has a root cause, and that root cause is the valuing of Israeli lives over Palestinian rights. So we don't believe that the Israeli government and its policies of occupation stand for us, represent our values, and we understand that as Jewish Americans, we have a real opportunity and even an obligation to try to change U.S. policy, which is extremely one-sided, to say the least, in its military, its diplomatic, and its economic support for Israel.
We've had the folks from J Street on a number of times, and they come right out and say, we are an openly and aggressively pro-Israel group. We just think that Israel's rather right-wing and militaristic practices are not in the best interest of the country, and so we're speaking out for what we think is the best interest of the country. Would you be on board with that?
You know, we're really a values-based organization, so we don't start from saying we're for this group of people or for that group of people or this solution mm-hmm. or that solution. What we say and the way we work is we're for human rights, we're for equality, we're for justice, we're for adherence to international law. Right. We're for these core values that right. certainly in the United States, we all can agree that we at least aspire to.
And then and that are found in Judaism.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and that are also, you know, part of the woof and weave of Judaic history.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Pardon my interrupting you.
And I think it's really important to us to not put one people first or one solution first and then have the values follow from that. Again, I think we believe that when we start from our commitment to equality and justice, we'll be able to figure out a solution that actually meets the inalienable rights of everybody involved.
Yeah. I have to say, you've got over at JewishVoiceForPeace.org, you've got a Israel-Palestine 101 sort of Q&A piece that, or you know, bullets and fill in the, you know, more detailed piece that I thought was just a really, really great history. You've got a really fine website there. So bring us up to date on what's going on right now with Israel and Gaza. What's the latest?
Yeah, well, I really, first of all, I would refer people to that 101 because I think one of the things that's going on right now is that this is an escalation of a situation that has really clear context, right? And that context is the Israeli occupation and the ongoing ways in which the Israeli society is set up, such as discrimination against Palestinians, the expropriation of Palestinian land is built into the very fabric of the state. So what we're seeing this summer began with the kidnapping of three Israeli settlers back in June. The Israeli government intentionally withheld information that they knew that those three children were dead and conducted an 18-day raid throughout the West Bank, which they really used as an opportunity to try to weaken Hamas, to try to weaken the PA, the Palestinian Authority, and to reassert its control over Gaza and the West Bank. What we've seen more recently in the last 2 weeks is Israel turning its attention to Gaza through a overwhelmingly intense aerial and now ground invasion. We've seen the Israeli army up to today. The latest figures are up to a little over 500 Palestinians have been killed. Tens of thousands of homes have been destroyed. Thousands are wounded. It's an unbelievably intense humanitarian crisis. And it is as terrible as it is also one-sided. So it's a real emergency that also sadly we've seen before. This is the same type of behavior we've seen from the Israeli state in 2012, in 2008, in 2006. So it's a pattern, and we need to understand that it's not simply a random explosion of violence. It's actually pretty clearly a state policy.
Right. What are there any specific policies that your organization, JewishVoiceForPeace.org, is calling for, Ari?
Yeah, we're calling for a removal of U.S. aid to Israel if it continues to use that aid to pursue these policies. So that includes direct military aid. Israel receives more aid from the United States than any other country in the world, to the tune of $3 billion a year. It includes diplomatic aid. The United States consistently protects Israeli human rights violations at the United Nations and other international bodies. And I think it also includes the type of aid that comes from the way that there's a cultural belief in the United States, and particularly in Jewish American communities, that it's Israel right or wrong. And I think in many ways that's actually the most important policy we need to change. We really need to stand up and stand up, especially as Jews, and confront the fact that in effect, our society treats Jewish lives as more valuable than Palestinian lives. And I think what we need to actually recognize is that all lives are equally precious, that all lives matter, that it doesn't matter if it's the lives of people who are like us or not like us. And it's actually that social change that we need to push for, to be able to hold the governments and the corporations that are driving this type of violence accountable.
Yeah. That has often seemed to me like if we were either our foreign aid dollars, either our $3 billion a year to Israel are consequential or they're not. If they're not, then we don't have much leverage. But if they are, then if we were to say, when you guys have this thing worked out, come back and talk to us. Until then, we're just going to apply this money to building schools in the United States. Seems to me like that might have some very, very positive impact. How do you deal with Shelley Adelson, for example, says he's going to spend $1 million a day, or at least there's speculation that he's going to spend $1 million a day, given to largely pro-Israel Republican candidates. Israel's his number one topic. In fact, one of the Republican candidates made some sort of a faux pas, and it was Chris Christie, and had to go on an apology tour to apologize to Shelley Adelson. So we have, you know, billionaires in the United States pushing the a very narrow perspective Israeli agenda or agenda about Israel, and then you have the influence of groups like AIPAC and whatnot. How do you think we break through that? We have about a minute left.
I think what I believe is that's actually already changing. I think if you look at any reputable studies of the Jewish community in the United States, you can see that there's a huge and growing divide between younger Jews and older Jews. And so I think that certainly we can't just ask Shelley Adelson to stop nicely. But I think if you do look at what younger Jews are doing, the organizing happening on campus in terms of opening up Jewish institutions, in terms of campaigns for divestment from corporations that profit off the occupation, in terms of Jews who have different opinions about Israel than the current status quo, asserting ourselves as legitimate leaders in our community. There is really a sea change happening. And I think that it's very similar to, I think, what we've seen with other movements, where over time, there's a massive generational change that makes equality possible, right? So I think that there are billionaires and there are the people. And I think that we're doing a great job organizing from that level for real change.
Well, you are. And let me again encourage people to check out your website, Jewish Voice for Peace, FORPeace.org is the website. And Ari Wolfweiler, the development director with Jewish Voice for Peace, thanks so much for dropping by and being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And keep up the great work. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's quite a conflict, and it's getting worse right now. So we need to take a look at this. Speaking of Shelley Adelson, this was, pretty amazing. The 2014 midterm races and calculations and all this stuff. There's a piece published over at politicalticker.blogs.cnn.com. It's a CNN, op-ed kind of thing that they post on their website at cnn.com. And John King and other top reporters lay out their thoughts on these things. And one of them starts out, if you had a big high-stakes project, thinks an extra $1 million a day might help? $1 million a day? Whoa. Well, leading GOP sources, whoever wrote this blog, John King and friends, well, leading GOP sources, Republican sources focused on the 2014 Senate races, say such a boost is being contemplated by Republican mega donor Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas casino mogul. They don't point out he's also a casino mogul in the island off China, Macau, which is Chinese territory. So this is arguably Chinese money flipping American elections on behalf of Israel. Really? Adelson has spent some time of late studying the map and receiving briefings on state-by-state strategy and candidates, and he's promising to help Republicans target a dozen seats now held by Democrats with the ultimate goal of picking up at least six, thus the Senate majority. Mitch McConnell becomes Senate Majority Leader. Harry Reid is a backbencher. The nuclear option is pulled. The Democrats will not be able to filibuster anything. The House and Senate start passing legislation, which the president has to veto. The veto it requires two-thirds in the Senate to overturn a veto. Okay, so the vetoes will not be overturned. And so now we have more gridlock, only this time the gridlock is going to appear to be caused by the president. And this is clear their plan for the next 2 years. This is the caucus room restaurant conspiracy on steroids. You know, moving forward, and I don't know, it this is so not America. We have one billionaire who's going to spend $1 million a day, and then they talk about the Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber of Commerce is already a big player in the 2014 battle. CNN's Peter Hamby talks about this. Hamby says the Chamber of Commerce has really moved away from just being a lobbying organization in D.C. to being more one of the more preeminent political players in campaigns, rivaling Karl Rove's American Crossroads. So that's a big deal in American politics. And the Chamber is backing Jack Kingston, for example, over David Perdue in the Georgia race. This is pretty amazing. I mean, here, so first you've got the billionaires funding our politics, and then you've got the Chamber of Commerce, you've got big business funding our politics. What happened to we the people? What happened to the first three words of the Constitution? It's like it's been completely lost, completely forgotten. It's really mind-boggling when you contemplate it. So anyway, I wanted to bring that to your attention. Cecily McMillan is going to be with us in the second hour of our program, and Gail Trotter in the third hour of our program. So we'll be back with more of the news of the day and anything goes summer. Your calls on pretty much anything you want to talk about right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and 20 minutes past the hour. And it goes summer. I was just ranting here about Shelley Adelson is thinking about tossing $1 million a day into six Senate campaigns to make sure that the Republicans take the Senate. If the Republicans take the Senate, then guess what? You will have the House passing legislation, weird crackpot stuff, but they'll pass it. They'll send it to the Senate. The Senate will pass it because Mitch McConnell will blow up the nuclear option, so Democrats won't be able to filibuster it. And then they'll send it to the White House for President Obama's signature, and he'll veto it. It'll go back to the House and Senate. Most of the vetoes will be cannot be overturned because the Republicans don't have a two-thirds majority in the House and the Senate. But nonetheless, the way this is going to play in the media over the following 2 years, 2015, 2016, is if the Republicans take the Senate, is that the president is the obstructionist. I mean, this is absolutely brilliant strategy that goes back to that caucus room restaurant meeting in 2009, January 20th, 2009, when Obama was being, having the day that he was inaugurated. That night he was out dancing at the balls, having no idea that 14 Republicans were meeting in the caucus room, conspiring to basically crash his presidency. and they've been remarkably successful. So there's the situation in Israel. The latest that I have on the situation with regard to MH17 and whatnot is that the rebels, and to call them rebels, this is something that I think, you know, a lot of Americans, our media doesn't do a good job with the backstory on this, that originally, unlike the people in Crimea, who overwhelmingly wanted to secede from Ukraine and voted to annex, to join Russia, and probably because the Russian fleet has been based out of Crimea for, well, since it was the Soviet fleet since the 1920s, and so what happens is that a lot of military officers are stationed there for 20, 30 years, and then when they retire, they buy a home there and they just retire there. So there was just, you know, it was overwhelmingly ethnically Russians or Russian Russians. But originally in the eastern part of Ukraine, this was 4 or 5 months ago when the surveys were done, they asked people, do you want to secede from Ukraine? And the people said, no, what we want is federalism. They wanted something which is what our founders put together. You remember the Federalists? The Federalists were arguably the very first political party. George Washington was a Federalist. And then you had the Anti-Federalists. Jefferson was arguably ultimately an Anti-Federalist. He created the second political party, which was the Democratic-Republican Party, which to this day we refer to as the Democratic Party. But the concept of federalism is that you have a relatively weak central government and you have strong states. Home rule, local decision-making. And in Ukraine, it had been, when it made the transition to an independent republic, it basically kept sort of the old Soviet model. So the people who are living in eastern Ukraine who are ethnically Russian, they speak Russian, many of them practice Russian Orthodox Christianity as opposed to other religions, the Christians mostly Protestant and Catholic on the western end. These folks were saying, we would like to vote for our own governors and our own mayors, because their governors and mayors, in most cases, were appointed from Kiev. And so originally, when they did the revolt, they were revolting on behalf of federalism. And then, of course, Ukraine, Kiev, the new government, the pro-Western government, started bombing their cities. And now you've got, you know, best guess, at least 100,000 refugees have fled into Russia living in tents. And I think it's probably reasonable to assume, although this is just an assumption, that a lot of these people who were originally saying, we just want to be able to vote for governor, are now saying, hey, you just bombed our cities, you killed a bunch of our people, to hell with you, we want to be our own country, or at least a whole lot more autonomy than we had, or even than we were asking for. And apparently the latest deal that Russia and Ukraine are trying to work out provides some of that autonomy. And I don't know the details of it. I'm not sure that any of us do. I'm not sure it's final. But there's that backstory. And then, frankly, my guess is that you got basically rednecks, you know, maybe drunken rednecks, who knows, with surface-to-air missiles, which, you know, our State Department and the Kiev government are saying were supplied by the Russians. I have not heard the Russian government explicitly deny that, but they're not confirming it, certainly. So I think it's probably reasonable to assume that they came from Russia. And that makes things pretty dicey. So anyhow, we'll see how that goes. There's still this big debate about, well, it's not a debate. I mean, there's still a big effort by Western countries. And it's being led now by the Netherlands, because so many of their civilians are dead on the ground, to say, hey, you know, let's come in here and do it. You know, let's have a ceasefire and let us come in and you know, do what's appropriate in a air crash. And you know, a lot of people are speculating that these separatists or rebels or whatever they are don't want that to happen, because evidence of their missile will be found, and You know, that may or may not be. But that's the prevalent story in the West, and their behavior reinforces that perception, whether it's right or wrong. Oh, and finally, I want to tell you, there's a movie that's got Ayn Rand in it. I mean, she even looks like Ayn Rand. It's called Snowpiercer. Have you seen this? Snowpiercer is amazing. Our former TV producer, Sam Sachs, told Louise and I about it. We went to see it at the West End Cinema here in D.C., which is the only place where it's playing. Funky little theater, you know, around the west side, northwest side. And, well, I'll tell you about it after the break. And then we'll pick up your phone calls. It's summer. It's anything goes summer. We can pick up anywhere.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, and got $10,000? And are you good buddies with the president of the private prison company down in Florida? Well, then you're invited to have lunch with Rick Scott. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the rest of us, the place where smart people get their news. Just an FYI, today we had JewishVoicesForPeace.org. Tomorrow it's going to be a Palestinian with a Palestinian for peace, organization. That'll be at the noon hour. We tried to get them on together, but it just didn't work out. Not because neither one wanted to do it, but just, you know, it was a matter of timing and scheduling and stuff like that. So, because usually I like to, this topic is so contentious. And there are, you know, I think there are two interesting dueling op-eds about the Israeli-Palestinian situation and Hamas and everything. In the New York Times, there was a piece titled Words to the Effect of How the West Decided to Go to War in Palestine. And they pointed out that Hamas had basically pulled out of, in order to appease Israel, pulled out of basically all functions, all roles in Gaza, and turned them all over to the Palestinian Authority. With the exception of still asserting that they were the democratically elected government, people that represented Gaza, and asserting that they still do not recognize Israel's right to existence, which is, in my mind, a huge problem. But then Israel said, as long as you're the head of the government, we're not going to pay the civil service salaries. I think it was 43,000 people. And so you got all these people who worked for a long time and never got their pay, which would have been a huge economic stimulus for Gaza. So you've got this one op-ed in the New York Times. It was one of the top 10 forwarded ones over the weekend. And then on the other side, the Washington Post, Charles Krauthammer wrote a piece in which he pointed out that, you know, Israel pulled out of Gaza. They had settlements there. They had greenhouses there. They forced their own settlers out at gunpoint. It was a huge big deal, you'll recall, when they did that. They said, and we're going to leave everything intact. We'll leave the greenhouses there. We'll leave everything. And, you know, the basis for an economy for you guys, good luck. Make it happen. And it's not exactly what Hamas decided to do, at least according to Charles Krauthammer, who is, you know, to the right of most neocons. But I thought the most trenchant observation was that of Nick Kristof this weekend in the New York Times, in which he said basically, among Gazans, the hard right is Hamas. And among Israelis, the hard right is Netanyahu. And so basically what we are seeing right now is the hard right wing of Israel facing off against the hard right wing of Palestine in Gaza. And there are no voices for peace on either side. The right wings are all about domination and control and violence. And I think that's a very interesting observation. I wanted to tell you about Snowpiercer. This is this amazing movie. It was, I think, made in South Korea. The director and producer is South Korean, a famous South Korean filmmaker. There are a couple of South Korean characters in it that really, really are good actors. And Tilda Swinton plays, nowhere in the movie does it say this is Ayn Rand, but when I was watching, I've seen the old, I remember watching Ayn Rand on TV, you know, when she was being interviewed by Mike Wallace 30 years ago. And I leaned over to Louise and I said, oh, my God, it's Ayn Rand. I mean, she is like, they've got her dressed and speaking like, and she's just doing a perfect Ayn Rand imitation. And she's in the, see, here's the storyline. Global warming was getting so bad, the world was going to be destroyed, and we figured that out. And so we thought we will spray this chemical, VX-17 or something, in the upper atmosphere to reflect the sun's heat back out. You know, it's a variation on the let's put titanium in jet fuel or something and make the chemtrails into contrails or vice versa, and you know, actually reflect the, you know, increase the albedo of the Earth, which is soundly rejected by most scientists. But in any case, that this was done, and the result was that they overcompensated and the entire world went into a massive ice age and everybody died and everything died. Except for this one train that's got this 4,000-mile route, around Europe and Russia, and part of China, it just runs this route continuously, and the engine is on some kind of giant perpetual motion machine at the front. And in the front half of the train, you've got people sawing and, you know, eating grapes and having orgies and having, you know, just the high life. And in the back of the train, it's like the beginning of what's that movie about the French Revolution? Les Mis, you know, it's like the huddled, dirty masses. I mean, dirty, literally covered with soot and eating you know, ground up insects in the form of these protein bars, and that's it. And I'm not going to give away the storyline beyond that. Just give you the setup, which you get in the first, you know, 3 minutes of the movie. And it's a very, very, it's good dumb entertainment on the one hand, but it's also, you know, thought-provoking and entertaining. And Tilda Swinton does just a brilliant Ayn Rand, even though I know it's not, she's not trying to play Ayn Rand. It just, it was like, oh, my God, that's Ayn Rand. So that all said, Tony in Philadelphia. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to comment on Gaza.
Sure. Go for it.
People keep talking about a two-state solution.
Well, both the Israelis and the Palestinians are on the record as being in favor of a two-state solution, as is the UN, as is the United States. So it's not like just some strange folks are talking about it.
Yeah, I don't see how that could possibly work. The only solution, in my mind, is a one-state solution with equal protection for all.
Yeah, the problem with that, Tony, is the same problem that Iraq would have, for example, and Iraq's probably not even the best example, maybe Iran,
mm-hmm.
One of these, quote, Islamic states. If the population within that state that was mm-hmm. Christian or Jewish was more than 50% of the state, you have a hard time saying if Israel was to incorporate the West Bank and Gaza and say everybody's a citizen, everybody has equal rights, their claim to be a Jewish state would end because the majority of the people would not be Jewish.
My point. Well, that's my point. Why does it have to be a Jewish theocracy? Why does it have to be an Islamic theocracy? Why can't it be a secular state like the United States or even Turkey? Why can't there be equal protection for all? And even at the cost of occupation by the UN or the United States, if we can occupy Afghanistan, if we can occupy Iraq, why can't the United Nations end this slaughter now and occupy Israel and get this done?
Well, I think the answer, and I think, frankly, the gypsies, the Roma people, can make an argument like this, too, and have for many years, that the pest side of the Budapest River in Hungary, or the pest side of the Danube, excuse me, in Budapest, should be, at the very least, and maybe, you know, a few hundred miles around, it should be broken off and given to gypsies as their homeland, or part of Romania, because it has to do with anti-Semitism, basically, and anti-gypsyism. I mean, these are two groups that suffer and have traditionally suffered from, you know, basically racial hatred in pretty much every country they've ever visited.
And this racial hatred I've seen in every country that exists on the planet. So my point is that
they need a place of refuge. I mean, that was the rationale between the 1948 annexation and creation of Israel was, you know, we got a history that goes back to the Crusades.
I agree. And Israel accepted they accepted the partition by the United Nations. That's why the United Nations should say, well, you accepted it before, accept it again, and now accept a secular state.
Right.
Where with equal protection for all, even if we have to occupy you for 100 years.
Yeah.
It would cost 1% of what it costs us to occupy these Muslim nations around the world that we've been occupying for the past 10 years.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying. I think in the real world, there's no possibility of that happening. Do you?
Mm-hmm. Well, first you have to talk about it.
Yeah.
And then you have to get other people to say, you know what, maybe if the world...
There, what you're going to run into is all the various states around the world, and there are, you know, Thailand is a Buddhist state. If you, I've been to Thailand many, many times. If you try to take, if you buy a Buddha in the airport gift shop and then put it in your bag and try and take it out of the country, they will arrest you. It's a crime. It's because it's a country with an official national religion, and you can't besmirch Buddhism, and you can't take Buddhas out of the country. So what that would do is it would call into, not necessarily call into question, and maybe they all should be, you know, and of course you've got a bunch of fundamentalist Christians here in the United States who are trying to make the United States an officially Christian state. In fact, an officially Protestant fundamentalist Christian state. And, a lot of us are very alarmed about that and really rather like the idea of a secular state. But there are non-secular states. There are religious states all over the world. And most of them are able to hold themselves together by virtue of majority population. And that's, I think, why Israel is saying, you know, we want to be a separate state so that we can maintain our Israeli/Jewish identity.
Identity, sure. No, I understand that. I just think that more and more people who really don't care that religion is causing most of this.
Well, it's not just religion. It's culture and ancestry and tribe, for lack of a better word. This is built into the DNA of people. It's what produces nationalism. It's what produces both the good sides and the ugly sides of nationalism. Tony, thank you for the call. A thought-provoking conversation. Other people want to get in on this and other topics as well. We'll continue that right after the break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if you've seen Snowpiercer and have a take on it, I'd love to hear, you know, your thoughts on that movie. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Brent in Roanoke, Virginia. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I think there are basically two surgeries that could be done on this situation in the Holy Land. You know, we've never had a monitored ceasefire. It is argued that Israel has violated every single ceasefire since 1948. They certainly did this last one. When those soldiers were kidnapped, the rampage they went on, the killing, the assassination of the Hamas leader, the sniping of children, the destruction of homes, the arrest, the violations of the previous agreement, arresting people who've been released, these were serious violations. Second point I would make is our politics are controlled by the people being basically ignorant. We have NPR telling us over and over again that Israel is acting in self-defense. That leaves me defenseless to try to make any headway with my senators.
Right. Well, and this is part of the conundrum. If you are a country and you've had over 1,000 missiles shot at you, how can you say that you're doing anything other than acting in self-defense?
Well, the missiles, when you assassinate a Hamas leader, you expect them to... The question is surrender. Are we forcing them to surrender?
I think
what Israel is exploiting is the pride of the people.
I agree.
They're just unwilling...
I agree. But here's what I would... You know, if I was sitting in the room with Hamas and the Palestinians in Gaza, my advice would be, look at what Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi did. That if you guys completely disarmed and became totally nonviolent and then started in a nonviolent way challenging the power structure and taking martyrs and still being absolutely nonviolent, I don't think it would take more than a few months to so deeply and profoundly shame Israel before the world that their behavior would radically change. But Hamas is, you know, the Palestinians have no history of that. There's not a law, you know, to the best of my knowledge, I mean, I'm certainly no scholar of Islam, but Christianity arguably has that at its core, right? The founder of Christianity, or the guy who's attributed as the founder, Jesus, I would say modern Christianity was actually created by Paul, but nonetheless, Jesus said, I will die rather than go any farther than Peter cutting that guy's ear off, and I already rebuked Peter for it. You know, nonviolence. I'm going to be totally nonviolent. And so that tradition, when Martin Luther King...
Point. I don't disagree with your point. However, all the attempts at nonviolence have been met with violence and a blackout by the American media.
I haven't seen any attempts at nonviolence. I've seen attempts at keeping quiet and keeping their head down. What I'm talking about is a whole different thing. I'm talking about an actual countrywide strategy.
Baleen has been having these nonviolent demonstrations for a long time. They're met with violence.
But they're having the demonstrations at the same time that they're digging tunnels and smuggling weapons in.
Because it's not covered.
No, they're having the demonstrations at the same time they're digging tunnels and smuggling weapons in. You can't have it both ways. Martin Luther King could not have been fire hosed in Birmingham at the same time he had 400 guys behind the building with machine guns. Nobody would have taken it seriously. I get what you're saying, Brent, and I'm not sure that we're disagreeing. I just thank you for the call. We'll be back. Speaking the truth to multinational corporations we'd really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. Julius in Orwell, Vermont. Hey, Julius, what's on your mind? You saw Snowpiercer?
Yeah, I did. My son and I watched Snowpiercer. It's on the pay-per-view on DirecTV. And we enjoyed the movie, but as it continued on farther and they made their way to the front of the train, we were both kind of trying to figure out really why the downtrodden people were even on the train. You know what I mean? I mean, I get the point of, you know, making the point of like the societal type of thing, but, you know what I mean? The movie existed. It just kind of like this.
Right.
Like,
why didn't they just disconnect those last 10, 12 cars of the poor, the poor and the wretched?
Because I couldn't see that they were really, except for using them for spare parts for little kids.
Yeah, well, that's, toward the end, you discover that they actually are doing that.
Right.
I don't want to give away the storyline. I think that could have been played up a lot, and I was expecting the protein bars to be Soylent Green, not to be insects. But, you know, who knows?
They could have been there very well for whatever use they could have. They could become of, you know, whether it's, free slaves.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, a lot of us are. But,
well, they had some of that. Remember, they came back and they asked the people, is anybody here play the violin? And there was one guy who did. And so
that's true.
They took him up to the forward cabins.
Some of the guy making the food was somebody they had known.
That's right.
You know, from back there. Yeah.
But,
Tom, hey, I enjoy your show. I'm kind of back on for a while. Once in a while, I drive a truck and I put a lot of hours in out here.
At some point,
I have to take breaks because I think my head's going to explode. But
well, Julius, thank you.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks for the call, and you know, keep on driving safely. Thanks so much. It's great to hear from you. Stu in Los Gatos, California, you disagree with our guest?
Oh, I disagree with him wholeheartedly.
Can you take off the speakerphone, Stu? It's hard to hear you.
Okay, how's that?
That's 1,000% better. So you disagree with his idea that equality and peace are high values?
No, I agree with those wholeheartedly. The problem I have is that people like him always are ready to condemn Israel first and not talk about what the Palestinians have to do. I mean, we can understand why you wouldn't want to try to negotiate.
Well, if you look at their websites, too, they're not.
Because
they're
a terrorist organization.
If,
and their sole purpose is to wipe Israel off the map.
Well, it's not their sole purpose. But they have not acknowledged Israel's right to exist. You're right. And if you look at Jewish Voices for Peace.org, you will find that they are not any easier on the Palestinians than they are on the Jews in this case. Or in the, on
I didn't
Israelis.
Hear one thing he had to say that was criticizing.
Well, he was answering my questions. I probably should have asked him a question about, you know, what are your thoughts on how the Palestinians are behaving?
Right, right. Well, but you see, this is a general tenor that, you know, no matter what most Jews, I would say, when they hear someone like that, and we're all over the political spectrum, right?
Right.
I don't agree with Sheldon Adelson on much of anything, but it makes us want to round up the wagons and dummy up and say, no, we're not going to even listen to you. You
yeah.
know,
yeah.
We really want to hear. There doesn't seem to be many voices on the other side that are saying that Hamas and Hezbollah and groups like that need to acknowledge Israel's right to exist.
I've been saying that from day one.
When they do that, then there will be peace.
Yeah, well, I'm not even sure that'll cause peace because the PLO had done so before and that didn't
You're
cause
right.
peace. But and in fact, I think that's one of the reasons that Hamas got elected, because the people in Gaza said, hey, we tried this and it didn't work. So screw it. We're going to go with the crazies. And
but you know what?
You know,
Hamas was not that kind of organization in the beginning. And Israel funded Hamas because of the humanitarian work that
that's
they
right.
did.
And that's how Hamas got elected, was providing schools, providing hospitals, providing
right.
jobs.
Right. And Israel was much to what's the word I'm looking for? Much to not blame, but to they were the ones that are responsible for providing a lot of that funding in the very beginning.
Yeah, much like we funded what became Al Qaeda.
Right, right, yeah.
No, I'm serious. Right. You know,
that's the problem. You see,
the Mujahideen. I mean,
the moderate voices of Palestinians are muted by because I can understand they're afraid for their lives to speak out.
Sure.
You know.
Well,
I
and
mean,
this is the point that. This is the point that Nick Kristof was making in the New York Times, and that I explicitly endorsed. I said, of all the articles I've read, from the one that, you know, is complaining that Israel should have paid the civil service salaries and we wouldn't have seen this mess, to Charles Krauthammer saying, you know, it's basically because the Palestinians dare to exist that this problem is going on. I thought Nick Kristof nailed it when he said, what you're looking at is right wing against right wing, and the voices for peace and the voices of rationality and the voices for civil society on both sides, on the Palestinian side and the Israeli side, are being marginalized. At least on the Israeli side, you've got the discourse in the country. Haaretz and other publications
right,
offer
right.
a progressive perspective and a labor perspective. The Labor Party, although, is pretty much dead now in Israel. But still, there are those voices. You will not hear those voices in Hamas, you know,
right.
in Gaza.
And that is the shame of it, you know, because Israel's been around for 60-something years already.
Yeah.
And before Begin, you know, there were always labor governments, and they were much more willing to work with the Arab side of the coin
yeah.
to try to make peace. But the Arabs never wanted to make peace, and the Palestinians have been used as pawns by the rest of the Arab world because of their hatred for the Jews.
Right.
So, you know, we've lost that moderation voice, at least on the Israeli side. You know, and that's why you have guys like Begin and then Shamir and Netanyahu, and they have to pander to even more radical voices like the guy, the Shah's party guy.
Yeah.
It's just a real shame. But we really want to hear what Palestine. Well, I hate to even use that word. Even the Palestinians hated that word. You know, it's a Roman word.
Yeah. Well, they used to consider it a slur. Now they've embraced it.
They aren't forced to fess up. And if you're a reporter in the Gaza Strip and you report badly, you're kicked out.
Well, what's his name? I'm forgetting his name now, but the NBC reporter who reported so empathetically about those four kids getting killed on the beach. And then they kicked him out, and they brought Richard Engel in to read his scripts. And now he's back. So NBC, and he's saying, this is over at Mediaite, he's saying, I'm back because of public opinion. So that's a good thing. Stu, thanks for the thoughtful call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, and Cecily McMillan on the line with us. She is the 25-year-old union organizer and Occupy Wall Street activist who was, Cecily, correct me if I'm wrong in telling this story. This originated with your having a breast grabbed from the back by a cop, to which you lifted your arm to push him away, and then you were arrested for assaulting him, and you just got out of Rikers Island for that, and you're facing charges in another case. Do I have that right?
Yeah, except for obviously being grabbed from behind by a figure. I had no idea who it was, or, you know, if it was an officer or not that
right.
had been grabbing me. Yeah.
Right. So this guy grabs your breast. You respond as probably any woman would, and you end up in Rikers Island.
Yeah. That's about it. Yeah.
Except that, you know, you were there for an Occupy Wall Street protest, and so maybe this is, I mean, we're seeing Occupy activists all over the country being prosecuted in ways that cause them, you know, to cause them to either plead guilty to or sometimes even serve time for felonies and thus lose their right to vote, lose their right to have certain kinds of jobs in the future, really damage their future. This sounds
right.
like, you know, the power of the state being badly misused.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I myself have worked with children my entire life as a camp counselor. I have 3 teacher certifications. I was former President Jimmy Carter's great-grandson's teacher at a cooperative preschool, actually.
Hmm.
And I will no longer be able to work with children as a violent felon in a public capacity until hopefully we get this appealed. You know, we're working in the courts to get this appealed.
Yeah, this is a travesty. Did anything happen to the police officer who grabbed you from behind?
The victim, as he called himself.
Right.
yeah, he, in fact, one of the reasons why the DA recommended that I do 90 days in jail was because I made a mockery, in her words, of women who are, in fact, sexually assaulted everywhere, and that by making such ludicrous claims, I was actually further injuring the victim in this case by damaging his reputation.
Whoa.
A man that has a wide and varied history of violence against children, all the way up to kicking people while on the ground in the face, to the point that he broke his own ankle and said that he had never kicked that man.
Whoa.
Yeah. So it was quite crazy.
Right. So over at your website, Justice for Cecily, CECILY.com, and your Twitter is Cecily McMillan, CECILYMCMILLAN.
Yes,
you're not only working to now they've got this second charge against you now that they're going to bring up. You're looking at 5 years probation, and they might throw you back in Rikers for another year. So
mm-hmm.
you're dealing with that and the ongoing legal process. You're trying to get a pardon or a reversal on that first conviction for its, you know, just on its face stupidity. And
yes.
And you're also speaking out about what you learned in jail, about women in jail. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the women that I met in there are really the true political prisoners. The fact that they have, you know, if you define political prisoner as somebody who forgoes the law or the rule of social norm in order to stand up for what you believe in, stand up for those you believe in, and take care of your loved ones, then I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone in Rikers who isn't a political prisoner in that regard, in the sense that these women are faced with very little resources, health, mental health, and I think that their conditions essentially mirror outside of Rikers, the conditions inside of Rikers that constantly work to send them in, keep them in, and send them back. So when I was in there, that the women themselves drafted the statement that I ended up reading, We, the Women in Rikers Demand, from 4 East Day and Rosen Singer Center. They made basic calls for basic human rights, like access to health care, mental health care. They asked for rules that were defined and defined in the best interest of the inmates, as well as the right to grieve those rules when they had been broken. They asked for resources from education and career training to mental health to social programs like against domestic abuse or dealing with PTSD. So, I mean, I think that what we're looking at here is not actually so different than what the Democratic Party has been calling for, at least in my lifetime, and especially progressive Democratic Party members as well. I think that what we're looking at is essentially a lack of access to basic human rights and basic resources and basic dignities that would effectually keep most of these women out.
Right.
They understand that this is their plight, and in order to take care of their families and take care of their communities, they do what they have to do. And that's why I do call them political prisoners.
Remarkable. I am probably your parents' age, and in my generation, the controversial television program was Hogan's Heroes, which takes place in a prison camp, a Nazi prison camp, and kind of makes fun of the Nazis. And the hit on it was that it minimized the horrors of the Nazi prison camps, which it certainly did. I'm curious if you think Orange is the New Black is helping or hurting the realities of and the future of women in prison.
Oh, I don't find anything remotely entertaining about our jails or prison systems. I actually do really oppose. I also think if you look at the medium, Netflix, when my friends had told me that there was an Occupy protester that was a new character in Orange is the New Black, and I talked to some of my friends in Rikers, it became very apparent that none of the women in there knew about the show to begin with. It was a very class divide in and of itself, a class race divide in and of itself, that this program is on Netflix and is tailored to people who have never been to a jail, never visited a jail, have nobody that they know currently incarcerated or previously incarcerated. And I'm very disturbed at what it is that the educated American public is seeing in this TV show. I mean, it makes me ill to even watch it.
Because it so minimizes the actual horrors of being in prison.
Oh, absolutely. And I think even beyond that, you could swing it the other way. I think it minimizes the sheer humanity, the depth of humanity that these women hold on to as a reserve to keep them living in inhumane societies. I mean, I think they're the real organizers here. The fact that they remain human in absolutely inhumane conditions is something that I am inspired and in awe of.
Yeah.
And I think that any lighthearted viewing of that process, not just the experience, because for me it was an experience.
Right.
For these women, it's a part of life. It's not a matter of if, but when they will go to jail for basically trying to live and take care of their families and loved ones.
Cecily McMillan, we have just about a minute left. Tonight, if you live in Florida, the CEO of Geo Group, private prison company, George Zoli, is hosting a $10,000 a plate dinner for Governor Rick Scott as a fundraiser.
Oh, my God.
I know Rikers is not a for-profit prison, but I'm curious your thoughts on the state of affairs in America.
My brother is in a for-profit prison in Texas, and the horror that he has experienced all the way down to being, I mean, mutilated, to having things placed in his orphan. I mean, I could not go on probably without interrupting your SBC.
Right.
I mean, the private prisons truly are a new level of truly horrific, I would say, genocide.
Yeah.
What I would call it.
Amazing. I absolutely agree. Cecily McMillan, the website justiceforcecily.com. Please check it out. Cecily, good luck. Keep us up to date, will you?
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us today. And I wish you the very best in your adventures going forward. We will be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And anything goes summer. I have a few news stories to kick around with you, but anything on your mind, give us a shout. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Wally, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Wally, what's up?
Hey, yeah. Well, first of all, you know, I thanks for having the show and the forums for people to talk. You do a great job and everything. And,
thank you.
You know, you mentioned Ayn Rand, and seems like every time we talk, she gets mentioned. But I had a thumbnail, just a quick thumbnail sketch of Ayn Rand. You know, she... you know, the Bolsheviks took their family pharmacy, and I think it made her real bitter. She wrote these books, making these capitalist heroes.
Yeah.
It's almost like she should have done comic books and had these superheroes.
Well, you know, she studied political.
That would have saved their family business.
Yeah.
I think that's what was going on with her. Well, anyway, that's just a thought about Ayn Rand.
Yeah.
I have a. You were talking about the campaign. Financing with Sheldon Adelson and
yeah.
stuff. You know, we also, the Democrats, which I'm one of, also have George Soros and these people to fight this.
George Soros is doing nothing like Shelley Adelson.
Not as effective.
Wally.
Yeah.
George, you know, I've been in the room with George Soros on more than one occasion. George Soros is nothing like Shelley Adelson. He is, first of all, he's giving nothing like the kinds of money that Shelley Adelson is. Secondly, to the best of my knowledge, he's not funding any specific candidates. He's not holding out his ring and asking the Democratic, potential front runners to come kiss it.
Right.
It's George Soros is interested in civil society and is committed to that and funds programs that advance civil societies, not just in the United States but around the world. And I think he's doing some pretty noble work, but. The Koch brothers eclipse George Soros in any given week, what Soros does in a year.
Okay, so they're completely overwhelm us.
There is no equivalent. There is no equivalent to the machine on the right. You know, Politico, go back about 4 or 5 weeks ago, Politico did an article about right-wing talk radio hosts and how Rush Limbaugh got $7 or $8 million from basically a Koch-funded or these right-wing billionaire-funded organizations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sean Hannity got $4 or $5 million. This is, ending up in being laundered through their show, but ending up in the pockets of these hosts. I have never, and it wasn't, and they had a list of 4 or 5 of these guys, Laura Ingraham and others, who were getting, hundreds of thousands to multiple millions of dollars every year as
right.
basically a gift from these right wingers. If they bring out a book, the right wingers will buy 20,000-30,000 copies, get on the New York Times bestselling list for a month, and then hand them off for free to WorldNet Daily to give away for memberships. Right? I mean, they take care of their own in a way that's mind boggling. I've been doing this program for 10 years, and I've never had a billionaire come to me and say, "Let me give you money in exchange for just being yourself, or in exchange for anything." Never happened.
Okay, can I make one more quick
yes,
point
sir.
About that? I was thinking the Democrats' big problem when it got, in 2010 in the midterm election, only 37% of eligible voters voted. That's one problem
right.
they have. I was thinking, can Democrats do they have enough money to actually hire people in a limited number of states, battleground states, to go around and register people and get them ID'd and transport them to vote? And that type of thing. Is that possible?
That it's called GOTV, Get Out the Vote. And that kind of Get Out the Vote program should be the central focus of the Democratic Party, particularly in red states, because if they could get enough people signed up and to vote. There used to be an organization that did that. It was called ACORN. And they were targeted in a way that was extraordinarily dishonest by Fox News and others and taken down. They're dead. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. David in Tampa, Florida. Hey, David, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I talked to you a couple of years ago, right before the Republican National Convention.
Mm-hmm.
I got to tell you right out of the outset, my satellite has been discontinued because of an issue with DirecTV. The only two channels I have are Link TV and Free Speech TV.
Uh-huh.
Is that crazy?
Well, it's kind of cool, actually.
Totally. And my two roommates hate it. But they're starting to come around. It's pretty interesting.
They want Fox.
But anyway.
Bring me back my Fox.
Huh?
Bring me back my fox.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I actually talked to you a couple years ago about all my friends here in Tampa saying Fox so-called news.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that call.
Yeah.
Quite a while ago. Anyways, I'm also from Lansing, Michigan. I was born in 62 in Sparrow Hospital.
Oh, cool.
And I learned that you were from Lansing and you started your career, I think, in like 67, somewhere around there.
Yeah. Yeah. I started in commercial radio in 67. Yeah. I was 16 years old. DJ at WITL.
Well, you're a total pioneer, and we all love you here.
Well, I was a disc jockey back then, not a talk show host. But you know, yeah,
I know.
When I first was on the radio. Anyhow, David,
and
to your question, you wanted to talk about the hundreds of millions of dollars being spent in the Florida political race.
$200 million. The headlines yesterday were $200 million put into the coffers of the state of Florida.
Wow.
For the Republican people, and it started back. I think they started recording around like 05, 06, somewhere around there. It was like 4.8 million, 16 point something, 30 something, 50 something, 80 something. And now they're up to $200 million.
Right.
I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, it's the logical consequence and the predicted consequence. If you read Justice John Paul Stevens's dissent, it's the predictable consequence of Citizens United and now McCutcheon. These two Supreme Court decisions that have said that corporations are people and can participate in politics in an essentially unlimited way, and that billionaires can use their money in an unlimited way because this money, the spending of money is, and this was a doctrine that was first laid down in 1976 in Buckley versus Vallejo, that the spending of money isn't a regulatable process. You know, we always used to consider that commerce, right? You go to a TV station, you buy an ad, that's called commerce. You're engaging in commercial activity or some kind of commerce, and therefore it can be regulated. But in 76, the Supreme Court, for the first time in 200 years of American history, said, no, it's not commerce, that's speech. And therefore, it's protected by the First Amendment. And Citizens United put that on steroids, and McCutcheon expanded it to now you can, you know, a rich guy can buy every politician in the country if he chooses to, and it looks like some of them are committed to it. I think you saw a real jack up in the amount of money in the election in Florida in the gubernatorial race because in the Buckley versus Vallejo decision, the core, the nubbin, the central point of that decision was that the post-Nixon, the 1974 campaign reform laws, made it so that rich people could not finance their own campaigns, so that there would be a level playing field. If an average working person wanted to compete against a multimillionaire in a campaign, the multimillionaire couldn't spend their own money. And in Buckley, the court said, yeah, they can spend all the money that they want. They can spend their own money. They can only spend their own money, but they can spend their own money because, after all, that's their speech. Money is their speech. And so Rick Scott, who, you know, was the head of a multi-billion-dollar company that was convicted while he was president of the largest Medicaid fraud or Medicare fraud in the history of the United States, you know, arguably a felon, decided that he wanted to become the governor of the state. And I think didn't he spend like $50 or $70 million of his own money to get elected?
Yep.
Yeah. So
a bit over 70.
Yeah, a bit over 70. That's my recollection. So that, I mean, you know, we had oh, what's his name? The guy who was the previous governor who's now become a Democrat.
Who, Charlie Crist?
Yeah, Charlie Crist. Thank you. Charlie sat in the chair next to me here about a month ago. He's been in our studio talking about this. And, you know, what a criminal Rick Scott is. Rick Scott can't run for re-election now because he's been term limited out. And so, you know, Florida is not the only place where it's going to be a $200 million race. And the other big problem about this is that you will not find anybody talking about this in the context that you and I are, of it not being a good thing for democracy. You will not hear that discussion on network television or on local television, because where's that $200 million going to go? It's going to go right to the TV stations. It's not even going to radio stations. It's like, you know, talk radio shows typically don't get political money because everybody figures, well, you know, he's already on my side. Why should I advertise? And, you know, it's just pretty amazing. But TV is where it's all going to go. David, thanks for the call. Thanks for pointing that out. Tom, in Madison, Florida, you wanted to talk about Shelly Adelson spending $1 million a day?
Yes, Tom. I'd like to give your listeners and your viewers a way to view the uber-rich's absolute monetary domination of our country and indeed the world.
Okay.
First, let's say a typical middle-class person could earn maybe what, up to $2 million in a lifetime, somewhere around there, maybe.
Yeah, I think I think average middle-class average median income adds up to about $1 million. In a lifetime, it's
about $1 million.
A family household, it's $50,000 a year, and you figure 40 working years, five times four, that's $2 million. Yeah, $2 million.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's say a 30 billionaire, like I guess Adelson's about in that area or more, maybe twice that. I don't know, but I did the calculation for a 30 billionaire, and it's it turns out to be that they can spend $1 million a day for 82 years and 2 months.
Right.
A 50 billionaire could spend $1 million a day for 137 years. I mean, that leads me back to when you said something like, you know, like we should tax these people such that they can't make any more than
1 billion.
I guess 900.
Yeah, 999 million. We got a website for it, nobillionaires.com. I think it's time for us to have a wealth tax, which is what Thomas Piketty called for in his book Capital. It's time to have a wealth tax and roll back the Reagan tax cuts and go back to saying CEOs make 30 times what workers make. And, you know, anybody who's got over $1 billion forfeits everything over 1 billion. I realize that ain't going to happen, but I think it would be good.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So you can see that over at nobillionaires.com. There are some very good billionaires. You know, Nick Hanna. I mean, some great guys out there. But welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And wow, it's just, you know, it's a beautiful day in the summer. We had a really nice weekend. We're getting this kind of polar vortex here in Washington, D.C., which is good news and bad news. The good news of it is that it's cooler and less humid. It's not like living in a swamp. The bad news is that this is the same cold air that's sliding down off the polar region that was making it like 10 below zero during the winter, which is really tough when you live on a boat. And was also causing warm air to come up over the Arctic and replace that cold air that was sliding down here because the Gulf Stream had been weakened. The Gulf Stream has been weakened, or the jet stream, excuse me. The jet stream, this river of air that circulates around the planet at about the 30th parallel, at the southern edge of the Arctic and the northern edge of the temperate zone, that river of air, of high-speed air, used to be fairly rigid, and you know, it was slightly modified by geography. It hits the Rocky Mountains, it loops up north a little bit. It comes, you know, the flatlands, it loops down south a little bit. So we used to get it in Michigan when I grew up there, but you never really got it below the Mason-Dixon line. Well, now it's going all the way down to Florida. Why? Because there used to be a big temperature differential between the mid-latitudes and the Arctic area. But the Arctic area is warming five or six times faster than where I'm sitting. And the consequence of that is that temperature difference between the Arctic and here is not as great. And if you know, weather 101, basic weather that science, atmospheric science that you learn in elementary school about cold fronts and warm fronts, you know, what determines how severe the thunderstorms are going to be and how much rain is going to fall out of the sky is two things. Number one, the amount of moisture, relative moisture in one mass of air versus the other. And number two, most importantly, the temperature of the two air masses. If there's a 10-degree temperature differential, you're going to have some wind. If there's a 30-degree temperature differential, you might have a tornado. And so, you know, there's always been this really substantial temperature differential between our latitudes and the Arctic. And as that diminishes as a consequence of global warming, particularly in the Arctic, we are getting weather in the south, in Washington, D.C., that really used to just be up in Maine. 70 degrees in the middle of July with very, very low relative humidity. I lived in Vermont. I lived in New Hampshire. I lived in New Hampshire for 4 years. I lived in Vermont for 10 years. We're getting Vermont weather. We're getting northeastern weather. And everybody thinks it's wonderful. And I'm thinking, okay, what this says to me is that these polar vortexes, this is the new normal, which means that this winter is going to be a bummer. And, you know, I mean, so we you know, summer gets a little better, but and it also means that the Arctic is warming faster than anybody thought. And that's like, that's not just bad. That's dangerous. So, you know, there's a lot going on, a lot going on. But it being anything goes summer, let's get you in on this. Nazir, in Prairieville, Louisiana, you wanted to talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Yes, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I was listening to the gentleman who was speaking about, you know, what was happening in Israel and the occupied land.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, you know, with all the 67 years and all the agitation and the one, the power is on one side and the other side has to take what is left over and what is refused by the side that has the power. If there was a two-state solution and there was not the annexation of the Jerusalem area, which Jerusalem, of course, we know is a highly economical thing for everybody in that area,
right,
calling it the Holy Land when it is most unholy with the most bloodshed shared in the world in that little piece of area, and fighting over that land. But the Palestinian, like you said, and I agree with you, that they have been kicked around by everybody, but they are a stable group of people that radicalism bred out of the unfair treatment that they have received over the years that Israel became a state.
Yeah.
And we in America has been totally biased and blindsided because we store 200 nuclear warhead in that country and call it Israel warhead. And we have to pay for that for the rest of our lives. And then the other thing, Tom, I want to make a point about is how Israel became a state. The Arabs did not want that, and they had owned the land. And because of the United Nations, they went along with how they created the border. And today, Israel is on the other side that is stating that they don't agree and they would not agree with whatsoever anybody else say in the world. And America agrees with them that blocked every item that came up in the United Nations.
Well, here's the thing, Nazir. We're not going to successfully relitigate 1948. It's never going to happen. Just like Mexico is never going to successfully relitigate the annexation of large chunks of Mexico by President Polk in the 1840s. Just like Germany is never going to get Alsace-Lorraine back from France. Just like Germany is not going to get back the Kaliningrad region from Russia. I mean, there are parts of the world that have been occupied or taken by force or taken by international consensus. Most of the Middle East, the lines that were drawn at the, you know, as the Ottoman Empire dissolved after World War I, the lines that were drawn by the Western powers, lines, you know, that defined Iraq and Syria and Iran and, well, not so much Iran, that was more historic, but Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, these were put together countries. And you can argue that all of it's wrong. You can argue that some of it's wrong. But the fact of the matter is that it's not going to change. And so within the context of the 1948 UN boundaries and agreement and the wars that have happened since then and land that's been taken and land that's been lost and land that's been given back, what do we do now? That's really the question in front of us, Nazir.
Well, I think the most important thing is that every country that has been cut up and put together and boundaries and was set up, everybody respect the borders, although they disagree with it. Israel continue not to respect their borders that was created by the United Nations, and they went beyond the border and created situation along with we in the United States assisting that country to go and invade into the people's land and then create an unfair living condition.
No, I understand that argument, and Israel would say, no, we were attacked, and we responded to the attack in the Six-Day War, and we seized that land because that's what you do in war, is you seize somebody else's land. That's why Alsace-Lorraine has gone back and forth and back and forth and back. And Kaliningrad, or Königsberg is the old German name, has gone back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And, you know, I'm not sure that making those arguments in the context of today is useful.
Iraq did not agree under Saddam Hussein, the country they call Kuwait. And they went to try to overtake Kuwait and bring it back. They said, that is our country.
Right.
The world stood up against that in the first Gulf War. And we went, and it was, I agree with what they did in order to stop Saddam Hussein from doing that. It was not the right thing, because borders should be respected, irregardless of how it come about, because that is what brings peace and everybody.
Well, but except that, you know, Saddam Hussein was saying that when, after Halliburton invented slant drilling, the government, the emir of Kuwait, the government of Kuwait was doing slant drilling underneath Iraq and stealing Iraq's oil. And there was no dispute of that. And Saddam Hussein said, if you're stealing our oil, stop. And they didn't stop. In fact, they increased the number of oil wells. And so Hussein then came to April Gillespie, who was, you know, George Herbert Walker Bush's State Department representative in the region, and said, may I take our 37th state back? And she said, the United States will not stop you. And so he did. And then, you know, the daughter of the former ambassador from Kuwait goes to the United States Congress and testifies that she saw babies being torn out of, you know, preemie babies out of incubators, when in fact no such thing had happened. And just, you know, and the Bush administration, the George Bush, the Herbert Walker Bush administration, used that to go to war. I think, of, you know, very thin pretext. I disagree respectfully, Nazir. I disagree with you. I think that that was another war in the region that we should have just stayed out of. If it was a really, truly wrong thing that Saddam Hussein was doing against the emir of Kuwait, there's a whole bunch. There's the Arab League. Let them deal with it.
Well, I agree with you in that respect. But I'm saying that there were ways to, in order to peacefully resolve these aggression that was made from one country to the other.
Right.
And, you know, for the false pretense that we used to go to invade Iraq, all of these conditions was self-made, and it really created now in our mind, and people who want to live peacefully, what is happening, you know, there's so much issues and so much thing that is going on, like we have prisoners.
No, Nazir, we're out of time here, but I agree with you. People just want to put their kids through school, be able to have a decent life, have a decent job, and we really need to be focused on that. Thanks for the
You're
call.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls here at Anything Goes Summer on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick with me. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Bernard, Kansas. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. I wanted to correct some misinformation. We were told that
about Ukraine,
crash site wasn't secured. Well, Friday I saw a report from the OSCE observers who said that they had secured the crash site Friday.
No, the OSCE observers did not say they'd secure the crash site. They said that they had finally been let into the crash site for a few hours.
They were there when they reported that they had secured the crash site.
Okay. Well, then, John, you've seen a report that I haven't seen.
And two, nobody mentions the fact that Ukraine has surface-to-air missile batteries, and that in 2001, accidentally, they shot down a Russian plane over the Black Sea.
Right.
And three, if the separatists are receiving aid from Russia, why did I see a report to where they went to a war memorial, started up a 70-year-old T-34 tank to be used in their defense?
Yeah, that was a little earlier on in the conflict. I don't know the answer to any of those things, John, and I don't think, you know, I don't think our media is serving us well. I would like to see some decent coverage of the bombing of the eastern Ukrainian cities by Kiev. I'd like to see some decent coverage of the refugee camps in Russia. Are they really there? How big are they? How many people are in them? You've got some people saying it's 400,000, others saying it's only 100,000. I don't think any Americans know that there's any refugees there at all. They don't know that these towns are being bombed. That's the reason why the so-called separatists, you know, were firing at aircraft in the first place. It's because they were bombing their towns and killing their people, which is not to justify what they're doing, and is not to justify either side. I mean, you know, we've been arming Ukraine and the so-called western part of Ukraine. Russia apparently is arming eastern Ukraine. I think it's time for all of us to take a deep breath, step back, and say, you know, let's work this stuff out. I mean, this is becoming like Israel-Palestine. So, John hung up. We have 1 minute. Let's see. Oops. Chuck, in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Chuck, we got a minute. So you got a quick one?
Yeah, I just was going to ask you, what are your thoughts about union dues being donated to Democrat candidates as being free speech?
I don't think it should be considered free speech. I think unions, just like for-profit corporations, should not have the rights of free speech, A. And B, it's important to note, under law right now, any union member who does not want their union contributions or dues to be used for political purposes by the union can simply say so, and the amount of that is deducted from their paycheck every month gets reduced, and the money available to the union for political activity is reduced. And a lot of people do that. So that's part of law. That came along with Taft-Hartley in 1947. So, you know, unions already are somewhat restrained in ways that corporations are not. But in my mind, I've seen a number of proposals to, quote, end corporate personhood, and they all only apply to for-profit corporations. And I think that's a huge mistake. I think it should apply to not-for-profit organizations as well, including unions, and, of course, including things like Karl Rove's group. So, Chuck, thanks for the call. We'll be back. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Victoria, I see you are in the Talk Radio News luxury broom closet suite in the basement of the White House underneath the president. What's up?
Yeah, it's so comfortable.
Yes.
It's just a dream.
Is it really? I've never been inside it. Is it actually the size of a broom closet?
It's the size of, it's a little smaller than what is euphemistically called on Zillow, a half bath.
Okay. So it's smaller than a jail cell and larger than a broom closet.
Yeah, about the size of a toilet.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it feels like one, too.
Yeah.
I just ducked out of the White House press briefing where Josh Earnest said it is unacceptable for Hamas to continue firing rockets aimed at Israeli civilians. He also said Israel must take even greater steps to meet its own standards of protecting innocent civilian bystanders.
I agree with both those statements.
So also today, at least 5 people have been killed and 70 injured by an Israeli strike on a hospital in Gaza. Many of the injured are doctors.
Oh, my.
Doctors say several Israeli tank shells hit the hospital's reception, intensive care unit, and operating theaters.
Oh, my. Oh, that's not good.
On Monday evening, that's tonight, right now, Israel said 7 of its soldiers had been killed in the past 24 hours, bringing the number of Israeli military dead to 25. Israel says it's killed more than 170 militants since Thursday night. So it's a pretty dire situation in Egypt. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is due to hold talks imminently, really, to try to arrange a ceasefire. The UN Security Council has issued a call for an immediate cessation of hostilities, but it didn't endorse a strongly worded draft resolution backed by Arab states. President Obama said the U.S. had serious concerns about the rising number of Palestinian civilian deaths and the loss of Israeli lives, and said the focus of the international community should be to bring about a ceasefire that can stop the deaths of innocent civilians. Also today, the Iron Dome missile defense system intercepted rockets headed for Tel Aviv. Also, the Hamas has begun attacking Israel on the ground. For the second time in a few days, militants used a tunnel dug under the border to infiltrate into Israeli territory. And this is one of the things that's really freaking out Israeli citizens. And this is one of the reasons why Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is unlikely at this point to yield to calls for a ceasefire.
When George Bush first blustered his way into Iraq, his popularity ratings went up spectacularly. As time went on and American soldiers started dying, his popularity collapsed. Is Netanyahu still on the upward swing domestically, or are there are domestic voices calling for him, calling for restraint in Israel?
There always are domestic voices calling for restraint in Israel. There always
are. There's an active and substantial peace movement there.
There is an active and substantial peace movement there. I have not seen any polling.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Okay. Moving along.
ISIS militants in Iraq are reported to have seized an ancient monastery dating back to the 4th century near Mosul and expelled the monks. They were allowed to take only the clothes they were wearing. It's a major Christian landmark and a place of pilgrimage. They were actually lucky to be able to flee, because they telling Christians, you either convert, you pay the fine, or we're going to cut your head off with a sword. That is what they're also saying to Shia Muslims, Druze and Druzes, and other members of other minority religions.
Is there yet a clearly established link between American funding of Sunni fundamentalists, anti-Assad Sunni fundamentalists in Syria, and ISIS?
I don't know that there is. I think that it would be quite difficult to prove, because I think the Americans would say that they have been funding moderate Sunnis in Syria.
Right. Okay.
That's
what we do say.
Exactly. President Obama renewed his demand today that Russian President Vladimir Putin use his influence over pro-Russia separatists in eastern Ukraine to clear the way for investigators to access the crash site of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17, saying time is of the essence. It's time for President Putin and Russia to pivot away from the strategy they've been taking and get serious about trying to resolve hostilities within Ukraine. Now, the Malaysian Prime Minister is saying that he has struck a deal with the separatists whereby they will get access to the site.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Malaysia is an uninterested third party, so that makes a lot more sense than either Russia or NATO cutting such a deal.
Right. So we'll see whether that takes place.
Right.
President Obama today, declaring himself on the right side of history, called on Congress to ban job discrimination against gay and lesbian Americans and signed an executive order doing so for workers of federal contractors.
This is going to be the next big Hobby Lobby thing, is it not, where they're going to go to the Supreme Court and say, you know, since our corporations are now recognized as persons with religions, our religion demands that we discriminate against gays.
That's very interesting. That could happen.
Yeah, I predict it will.
That could happen.
But I think that they're probably not going to get such a friendly reception from this court. There are several members of the court who, even in their right wingness, one in particular, who seem more to be friendlier to gays than they are necessarily to women.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
A Florida Keys judge who last week ruled the state's ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional was asked today to permit gay couples to marry in Monroe County despite a pending state appeal. So we'll see how that goes.
Okay. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and free-don.org. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful day there at the White House.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And live in the studio with me is conservative writer and tax attorney and co-founder of Schaefer and Trotter PLC, a law firm, right?
Yes.
You're a lawyer.
Yes.
Is Gail Trotter. Her website is Gail, G-A-Y-L-E, Trotter, T-R-O-T-T-E-R.com. And she most recently has written a piece for The Hill, thehill.com. That is titled Fix the Tax Code to Stop Offshore Exodus of U.S. Companies. Gail, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the premise of your piece?
The premise of my piece is that our corporate tax policy is in complete disrepair, and we have a very simple way that we could fix this to lower the corporate tax rate, but instead we have many liberal pundits saying that we need to invoke patriotism to keep these U.S. corporations on American soil when the easier solution is just to lower the tax rate.
Well, you have 100 of the 400 largest corporations in America paying no taxes at all last year. You've got 98% of all corporations paying no taxes, although that number is a little fudgy because probably 95% of all corporations are little operations,
yes,
you know, like this show, which is a
right
corporation. And at the end of the year, if you got any money left over, instead of paying taxes on it, you buy a new copy machine, you know. For large corporations, I mean, you've got the corporate jet deduction. You've got the over $100 billion in various deductions for the oil industry.
Which we should get rid of.
Yeah,
we should get rid of and lower the corporate tax rate.
Manufactured in America deductions that Starbucks is using because
right
they say roasting coffee is manufacturing. I mean, it's all these things. I don't disagree with you. I think that if we took our corporate tax rate down to 25% or 28% or something reasonable in the neighborhood of where the capital gains tax is, and did away with all the loopholes, that, you know, we'd be better off. But you and I both know that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen as long as our Supreme Court keeps saying that billionaires and corporations can buy politicians. We've got a much larger problem.
Those are unrelated issues. Those are unrelated, totally unrelated issues.
How do all these loopholes get written into law?
Because congressmen do not stick up for a fair tax code, and they are subject to influence. And instead of having – what is the point of the tax code? What is the point of the tax code? To collect revenue for the federal government.
No.
So the federal government can take care of the business that it needs to
accomplish. I would say that's the least important reason that you have a federal tax code.
And that's where we would disagree.
Okay. I would say number one is to extract from companies and individuals an amount of revenue that reflects their use of the commons.
No.
Right? If you've got a corporation that is using publicly educated employees at your and my expense, they're using the roads at your and my expense.
Because our public school system is so great.
It actually is. We're turning out high school graduates at a higher level than we have in the history of the United States.
Who can't compete globally. We're a global economy now, and the U.S. is so far down in
schooling.
You know,
schooling. We can both make a good argument for having a better public health system, or public school system. But in any case, these corporations want to use all these things that we're paying for. The court system, more than half the court system is paid for by you and me with our tax dollars. It's not paid by GE. They're not paying any damn taxes.
It's both. Think of Apple Corporation. That company
which is sitting on $100 billion
offshore. Exactly, because of the repayment. repatriation taxes. And if we don't get rid of these repatriation taxes, we're going to have over $1 trillion left overseas where it cannot come back to the U.S. It cannot be invested in research. It cannot be invested in dividends to corporate shareholders.
So the way that Apple makes this money and keeps it offshore is by self-selling. I'm sure you're familiar with this. You got a product that you manufacture. You got $10 worth of manufactured cost. Ultimately, you're going to retail it for $100. You can sell it to yourself for the $10 manufactured cost, which then when you sell it for $100, you have a $90 profit, leaves the profit in the United States, and so you're subject to tax. Or you can sell it to yourself for $90 and sell it for $100 and show a $10 profit here and an $80 profit in China, leave the money over there in China, and not pay any taxes
on it. And see,
that is exploiting the American consumers.
No, that's a perfect example of perverse incentives on U.S. corporations.
It used to be illegal.
Apple, I will tell you, in 2012, was the largest corporate taxpayer. It paid $6 billion in taxes to the U.S.
They were one of the largest earners in the United States.
But they have to respond to economic incentives. And we have a global economy, and the U.S. has to compete for corporate taxpayers. So if you continue to try, not you, but if the congressional leaders and Obama continue to push for the corporate tax rate to be high, they're just going to move all of this money offshore. It's going to go to foreign treasuries. It's going to benefit foreign citizens and not American citizens.
Before the Reagan administration, you could not domicile yourself outside the United States for tax benefit. And you could not do self-dealing. If you tried doing that self-dealing, you'd get nailed for it. I mean, it's just, you know, Reagan essentially rewrote the tax rules, and it's been getting worse and worse and worse ever since.
I would agree the tax rules have been getting worse and worse ever since the Tax Reform Act of 1986. We needed more of that. We need less complication. Every year the tax code grows. The Code of Federal Regulations grows. We have these horrible decisions that are made by tax courts.
I started out saying I don't think that we collect taxes to pay for government. And to the extent that I think that we capture the costs that these companies inflict on their communities.
But see, that's Senator Warren's idea that you didn't build this road. I mean, we are paying for this. Companies are paying for this. We have double taxation of corporations. When they pay taxes, when Apple pays $6 billion to the U.S. Treasury, who actually pays that tax? You and I do when we buy Apple products.
No, the stockholders do.
It gets passed on.
The stockholders do.
And not only that,
it's money that didn't go to dividends.
No, it's money that didn't go to dividends, and it raises
and
the cost of their products as well.
By the top 10% of Americans.
So you have retirees who are depending on the dividends, and they can't get the money
because it's not about the little guy, going
to the United States Treasury or ultimately overseas.
Gail, it's not about the little guy. It's about the big guy. It's about the billionaires. And you know,
you'd like it to be that way, but that's not the truth. That's not the data.
Your argument,
the numbers do not show it that way.
Then why is it that from the 1940s until the 1980s, before Reagan changed these tax rules, we had not only the strongest middle class in America, we had high levels of corporate tax compliance. Corporations during the Eisenhower administration accounted for 36% of all government revenues. It's now 11% of all government revenues, which means that you and I as average taxpayers are having to pay almost 90% of government revenues, while the corporations are richer than ever.
Okay, so what happened after World War II? We were able to spend a lot of money and American lives to protect freedom, to protect Europe. And after that, World War II decimated the top economies around the world. And we had a dividend from the amount of investment that we made into World War II. We were the top country. That's not the case anymore.
Exports went
when
up
you
by
look
2%.
At the top countries under the OECD numbers, we have the top rate. So you can argue about the rate. Should it be 28%? Should it be 25%? But we should not be dead last with the highest corporate tax rate, because now
I've already told you I don't disagree with that, but I'm saying that if we don't do something about the fact that billionaires and corporations can buy politicians, you're going to have a lower tax rate, and those loopholes are still going to be there.
Well, I come from the perspective, I'm a lawyer, I advise small businesses. So when I think of corporations, I think of the moms and dads who own the corporations. I think of the female entrepreneurs.
That's not where the problem exists.
And those are the people who are squeezed. Those are the people who are squeezed because they don't have the same deductions.
Right.
They don't have the same ability to...
They can't buy a politician.
And they can't move offshore either.
Yeah.
So we need to change that, not only for keeping these companies resident in the United States, but also for smaller corporations.
You want me to be able to take the company that owns this show and domicile it in Ireland and not pay taxes. Is that what you're saying?
I'd say to fix that problem, I would not try to trap you here by adding more and more law
Why?
And regulation.
I'm making my money off
America. I would do the simple fix for that and lower the corporate tax rate, because we don't blame Aunt Bertha and Uncle Harvey, who during their working lives live in New York State, and then when they retire, they don't want to deal with those high taxes, so they move to Florida.
I don't think you're going to find any Democrat who would say, I'm opposed to lowering the corporate tax rates if it's associated with closing the loopholes.
Well, except for Robert Reich, except for Alan Sloan of Fortune. No, I had two that I named in my piece.
Robert Reich has been explicit that we should close the loopholes.
No, they think that we should shame U.S. corporations. And the truth is there's an easy fix that is an American fix, too.
Yeah, cut their taxes. Yeah, it worked really great. You know, Reagan cut taxes for billionaires, and now we've got the biggest income economic
inequality. I'm talking about the moms and dads who own these corporations.
That was my point. You know, during the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. Well,
when we had no competition.
It's a straw man. Gail Trotter, gailtrotter.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That's G-A-Y-L-E, trotter.com. And her article's over at The Hill. We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And if I can make my mouse work, Oneida, watching us in Maine on Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Oneida, what's up?
Hi. I don't disagree with much you say, but I think you and the whole world is misusing the word Semitic. I went to my dictionary today to find out exactly what it meant, and it's not people, it's the language. Basically, African language and Asian language, and it includes Hebrew and Arabic. So that means if you're anti-Semitic, you are anti both Hebrew and Arab.
That's interesting. Yeah, the Semites are folks from that region of the world. But I think generally speaking, when we say anti-Semitic, and I was talking earlier about why does Israel have to exist? Well, because there's anti-Semitism all over the world. I think anti-Semitism, while technically you're correct, is pretty well understood to be, anti-Jewish.
I guess that's because people made it that way.
Well, could be, yeah. Oneida, thanks for the call. It's an interesting thought, interesting comment. I'm curious your thoughts on Gail's suggestions. Let's get into that, although she's headed out. Snowpiercer, this incredible movie that Louise and I saw last night. We did our Sunday night ritual, and which is going over to the Ethiopian restaurant. There's an Ethiopian restaurant here in town that's one of the best that I've ever eaten at anywhere. Almost as good as Dalos in Portland, Oregon. And so we go to the Ethiopian restaurant, and then we went out to a movie. We had a date night, and the movie was Snowpiercer, and it was just extraordinary. And there was this woman played by Tilda Swinton, who it was like, oh, my God, it's Ayn Rand. So anyhow, I just wanted to give you the heads up on that. The other thing, I know we've had a couple of people. Somebody called in and informed me about the 5-2 diet. And for months, Louise and I have been doing this or trying to do this. We're 5 days a week, eat whatever you want. We're vegetarians, so it's always been within that context. And then 2 days a week, you only eat 500 calories. And I guess we haven't been as good about it as we should be, because I think I've gained about an inch around my waist in the last couple of months, which is not, fun. So I'm going back to my roots. I'm going back to the Arnold Arendt diet. And the exception to that is every Sunday night we go out to the Ethiopian restaurant. But Arnold Arendt, back in the 1920s, wrote this book called The Mucusless Diet Healing System. And he said, don't eat any foods that form mucus in the body. It's the basis of all disease, which includes grains, all starchy foods, potatoes, all these things. So basically it's fruit and green leafy vegetables. And that's it. We're trying that. And if you check out, there's actually a website for the Mucusless Diet Healing System, which astounded me, because, you know, this was the diet that Louise and I were on the first couple of years that we were married. Louise was on this diet through her first pregnancy. And so we're going back 12 months. We'll be back. If you've ever heard of Arnold Eric, give me a shout. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Mark in Chicago. Hey, Mark. What's up? You want to talk about Israel and Palestine? Mark? Can you hear me? Okay. Let's try Amy in Madison, Wisconsin. Can you hear me, Amy?
Oh, yes, Tom.
Great.
By the way, I lost 87 pounds, and the key is aerobic exercise.
Yeah.
You can follow any diet if you walk.
Yeah, you're right, and I'm walking more, and I need to be walking more. I need to be taking cars and public transportation less. In fact, Louise and I walked about 2 miles on Saturday, which isn't, okay. I realize, is nothing, you know, but it was a start.
Yeah, Tom, can I tell you something that I think maybe disabled people on SSDI can do?
Sure.
Proactively?
Sure.
The federal government funds in every state a department, an office of vocational rehabilitation.
Uh-huh.
And by federal law, if you're on SSDI, you get priority so you could get in.
Mm-hmm.
I just did that. And they're willing to let you work part-time so you don't lose benefits.
Uh-huh.
And so right now I can work 3 hours a week on minimum wage and not lose benefits that I get from the county. That's the most restrictive.
Wow.
And then I'm trying to get a minimum wage as a bagger in a grocery store 3 hours a week, and then in 2016, increase that to 10.
That's great. Amy, thanks for the heads up. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Oh, by the way, today is the 21st of July. On this day, the Scopes Monkey trial started. The U.S. VA was formed. The NATO was ratified in the Senate by an 82-13 vote. That was in 49. In 1962, 160 civil rights activists were jailed in Albany, Georgia. On this day in history, this is 1969, Neil Armstrong stepped on the moon. Richard Nixon was president. And he still believed in, hey, let's do big things. Republicans don't believe in that anymore, kind of tragically. In fact, 5 years later, on this day in 1974, the House Judiciary Committee approved two articles of impeachment against Nixon. And, on this day in 1984, appropriately, it was the first documented case of a robot killing a human. A lot of interesting stuff here in Sue's database. And on this day in 2011, the space shuttle program ended. Interesting. This is the day we walked on the moon. And then this is the day that we ended the space shuttle program, because we can't afford it anymore, because Republicans won't pay for anything anymore. Great. Greg in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Greg, what's on your mind? You want to talk about Israel and Hamas?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I don't normally call in to talk about foreign policy, but I think in this case we have a real opportunity. So I kind of wanted to talk about the Israel-Hamas conflict and what we as the international community can actually do going forward.
Okay,
and
go for it.
I just wanted to outline a quick solution, which might be important. Well, first of all, I just start off, you know, I'm not a big fan of Netanyahu. I think a lot of prime ministers on the left were way more effective in negotiating peace agreements with Abbas. But having said that, I just want to focus on Hamas, because Hamas is not good, basically, for the people of Gaza.
Right.
You know, they've been in power for 7 years. The first thing they did after getting elected is basically expel all the other government members, you know, and take over the place. They have a near monopoly on the arms. They basically confiscated all the arms from the clans in Gaza. And, you know what they engage in, the Talibanization, the repression of gays and women, the, you know, using educating the kids to fight for their cause and so forth.
Yeah.
So what I want to say is this. What I want to say is that if there is going to be a peace solution in Gaza, there could very well be, but the international community has to stop just talking about it. And after Hamas is gone from Gaza, they can come in there and help to state build, to actually get in there and help the Gaza.
Well, this is what would have prevented a Hamas from being elected in the first place, is if we had taken any fragment of the aid that we're giving to Israel and we'd gone into Gaza and built schools for girls.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, non-state actors were the only ones doing that, because there's, you know, hardly any interest unless we tell people that there's oil in Gaza. The countries are not going to go there. It's complete hypocrisy.
Yeah, I know. It's just like at the end of Charlie Wilson's War, you know, where Charlie Wilson goes to Congress and says, OK, you know, we funded this guy Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen, and they kicked the Soviets out of Afghanistan. But now the country's in shambles. Can we just appropriate a little tiny fraction of what we already spent on rebuilding their schools and their civil society? And Congress said, nah, don't think so. And bingo.
Exactly. And that's the big problem. And, you know, I call on the international community this time to actually, I mean, Gaza has borders. Israel's not going to go in there if rockets are not being fired.
Right.
The blockade, Egypt can lift the blockade, you know, if UN inspectors will certify that there are no Qassam rockets being smuggled. You know, this
right.
can be done. But the international community is not going to do it, and the Arab League's not going to do it, because the Arab League has been denying, even to Palestinian refugees, even from the Syrian war, citizenship, all the Arab League countries. So I don't see anyone solving.
I think most of the Arab League countries are afraid of ending up with a situation like they have in Jordan, where roughly half of your entire population identifies itself as Palestinian rather than Jordanian. That's not good for domestic politics.
It's not perfect, but at least they have a state. These guys are worse off.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. And I think that this is a great opportunity for us to do some nation building. And you know, to the extent to which the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is used as a recruiting tool by all the right-wing whack jobs in the Middle East, just demonstrates to us. I mean, this was the Abbas, you know, the guy who flew who directed the 9/11 thing. This was the number one thing that he cited, and you know, Osama bin Laden, the number one thing that he was citing. It's a cancer that needs to be cleaned up, and I'm with you, Greg. I hope that this awful situation, just like I hope the awful situation in Ukraine, provides an opportunity for everybody to take a deep breath and say, how can we work this out peacefully and make this world a better place? Greg, thanks a lot. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, this is interesting. Scientists in England are reporting that pot shrinks cancerous tumors. Yikes. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And the Washington Post reporting, as Victoria Jones did during our news report at the top of the hour, just before the top of the hour, that the Malaysia has cut a deal with the rebels in southeast Ukraine to release the black boxes and the remains, and to get investigators into the site of the Flight 17's crash. So it looks like things are moving forward. That is good news. Number 12 in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You used to be taxi driver number 12. Back, KTRC was one of our very first live radio stations back 10 years ago.
I am. I still am.
You're still a cab driver. It's great to hear you.
I went back there. I needed a job a few years ago, and they hired me back.
That's great. We haven't talked in years. So what's up?
We haven't because I've had a heck of a time getting through to you. Most of the times when I call you, it goes from a ring to a busy signal, or I call you and I get that pre-recorded message that says the number is no longer in service.
Yeah, that's because all the lines are full, which is the situation right this minute, in fact. All 12 lines are full right this minute. So it's
well,
good.
I was calling the wrong number or something was wrong with my phone service or something.
No, it's when the lines are all full, weird stuff happens. I can't account for that, but that's what happens.
Okay, well, I'm just voicing that's my constructive complaint for you for today.
Thank you.
Anyway, I first of all, I must say off the subject that I was going to talk about that I don't think taxation is to pay for the government or to pay for the commons. It's to pay for the shareholders of the Federal Reserve's dividend.
Oh, that's interesting. The second point that I kept trying to make, and I never really got an opportunity to, is that I think that taxes, number one, are to capture the cost, you know, that people or governments inflict on society to have them pay for that cost. And number two, to modify their behavior. We use tax policy to modify corporate behavior. We have from forever, basically. And in fact, from the George Washington administration, the easiest and best example of that is tariffs. We used to tax imports into this country to reflect the cost of cheaper labor overseas. We ceased doing that during the era from the 80s to the end of the 90s, during that 20-year period, and it was a huge mistake. We blew up 200 years of U.S. tax policy that was serving us.
So. I think it's. I'm a little bit more cynical. I really think it's what we call inflation. The shareholders of the Fed call their dividend payment, and that's where I think taxation goes to.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've heard a lot of complaints from this radio station, from people calling in about Citizens United, and I'd like to mention that Citizens United is due to a very bad law that came out in 2002, which is the McCain-Feingold, I always blow this title, the McCain-Feingold Campaign Reform Law, which basically criminalized, you know, what they called electioneering communications 30 days or 60 days before a primary or an election. And the wording of that law was so blatantly against the First Amendment, I was like, well, it's only a matter of time before there's going to be a ruling that says that you can't ban speech, regardless of, you know, if you agree with the speech or not. And what we got, it was the Frankenstein's monster of McCain-Feingold with Citizens United.
Well, yes and no. Originally, the Citizens United was challenging that 60-day period, and additionally was asserting that, you know, within that 60 days their right to free speech was violated. They made that argument before the Supreme Court, and Chief Justice Roberts said, you know, that's a good argument, but we would really much rather rule on something much larger than this. So would you please come back and argue, since we've granted you standing, would you please come back and argue all over again a whole brand new case that involves your right as a corporation to have speech and your right, to have speech pretty much any time? And they did, and the result of that was Citizens United. And I would encourage you, number 12, to read the dissent, Justice John Paul Stevens' dissent in Citizens United. It will curl your hair. It's really worth reading because we are seeing right now exactly what he predicted. And in the concurring decision, Scalia essentially ridicules Stevens' dissent, and history has proven Scalia to be a fool in this case.
Okay.
So,
I'll go back to my original point, and I understand your point here. But if there was no, you know, what I call the Incumbent Politician Protection Act of 2002, the McCain-Feingold, I don't think we would have had a Citizens United. And
well,
because the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law, and in 2002, Congress did make a law abridging the freedom of speech.
Well, assuming that you think that spending money means speech. And that's what up until 1976, no American politician or legislature ever agreed with. And they still don't. To the best of my knowledge, there's never been a law passed that says spending money is the same thing as speech. That's a doctrine that the Supreme Court, at the behest of Lewis Powell, came up with in the Buckley versus Vallejo case in 1976. That was when it first appeared. Up until then, we regulated the spending of money. You've got money, okay, cool. You want to spend money for politics, okay, cool. But you're spending money. It's a commercial activity. You're giving money to a television station. We can regulate that.
It's still the electioneering communications was the term, I think, that was unconstitutional.
But those communications involve the spending of money.
True. And so you're basically, it's like two sides of a coin here, and it's still speech. Which does go against the First Amendment. And I'm very pro First Amendment. And like I said before, if this thing did not pass in 2002, I don't think we would have had Citizens United today.
No, it we would have, because this court, ever since 76, has been chipping away and chipping away and chipping away at the will of the people. The fact of the matter is that if you go back and look at the original, you know, the debates for McCain-Feingold, the argument that John McCain made was that it was wrong, crazy, counterproductive, un-American for members of Congress to have to spend half their day begging for money. That it compromised them, it corrupted them, it reduced people's belief in the integrity of the political process, and therefore let's put a cap of $2,400 per person, an absolute cap on donations, and you know, let's prohibit certain other behaviors that can be done. And a lot, you know, the reason for the 30-60-day thing was because once you've got the cap on donations, if somebody comes along and drops a bombshell kind of ad at the last minute, there's no way to go back to those people and say, we need some more money to answer this. Your hands are tied.
So John McCain's response to complaining about his poor situation of having to raise money to be reelected was to take free speech down with it. We're not going to agree on this if you're going to basically go back to the money thing. I think free speech is pretty much an absolute thing, whether it's free or paid for. It has to be legal 365 days a year, and that's my point.
I totally agree that free speech should be free, and it should be available to anybody who wants to use it. But that doesn't mean that if I decide that I'm going to, you know, if I'm a billionaire and I'm going to give millions of dollars to a half a dozen politicians and implicitly demand that they dance to my tune, you know, the way Shelley Adelson does, where he says, you know, come out here to Vegas and kiss my ring, you know, I don't call that speech. I call that corruption. We used to call that bribery.
All right. Well,
how is a bribe free speech?
Pardon me?
How is a bribe, giving money to a politician, how is that free speech?
That's not speech, because it's basically not banning something from being said.
Right, it's electioneering. Electioneering is not speech. Electioneering is getting people elected.
Communications, that being the speech part.
Well, the communications part of it, if it's costing you money and it's work and it's inuring to the benefit of one guy and hurting another guy, how is that not a variation on bribery? We used to have really strong laws against this. You know, to look at the Tillman Act in 1907.
True, but you okay.
And that stood. You know, the Tillman Act was struck down by Citizens United. And John Roberts is saying, I won't blow up precedent. The Tillman Act is still on the books. It's been on the books since 1907, but Citizens United struck it down in 2010.
So you're saying that there should be the ability to bring someone in front of a judge and then charge them with speech crime?
Charge them with a money crime.
Okay, so you're saying money, I'm saying speech. It seems like the politicians are using this.
I think it's important for us to differentiate between the two. Spending money is spending money. Speaking
speech
is speaking.
Speech
is speech.
When you tie an anchor around speech and you try to take it down with money, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to say, well, you know, we're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I'll go back to the
point.
But
see, your absolutist perspective has simply brought us a new era of bribery.
Okay, and that's just one of the dangers of having the freedom to begin with.
But that's not freedom. It's, you know, freedom to corrupt politicians is nothing that the founders of this country ever would have agreed with.
But I don't think.
And I don't think most Americans agree with. And I don't think you call that freedom. I think you call that bribery and corruption.
Okay, I'm going to go back to my original point. It was still criminalizing speech 30 days or 60 days before an election or a primary.
Yeah,
and I don't want to argue with you past that. I think everybody who's listening to us argue right now should go read both opinions and then come up with their own decision, because literally McCain-Feingold did outlaw speech 30 days and 60 days before a primary.
Certain types of it, yes, it did, and I think that you probably could make a constitutional case on that, but that's not what the Supreme Court did. They said, we want to take this big and wide, and we want to do something that no legislature has ever done, no president has ever advocated. And, in fact, presidents, literally since Grover Cleveland's State of the Union address in 1887, which I encourage you to read, where he talked about corporations, which should be the carefully constrained creatures, you know, these creatures of law, which should be the carefully constrained servants of the people, have risen up, and now the iron heel of corporate power is upon the neck of the average citizen. He said that in front of Congress in 1887. Ever since then, every president has spoken. I mean, President Obama spoke out against Citizens United in his, I believe it was his State of the Union address the next year, where Sam Alito said, you know, you lie, or no way, or whatever he said. It wasn't you lie, not true. Anyhow, number 12, it's great to hear from you. Thanks for the call. And we'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls in just a second. And welcome back. Michael, in Imperial Beach, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. We all know about where we came from, the aristocracy and the peasants. But as much as I hate to say it, because I disagree with Gail Trotter. But was she right? After World War II, is the only reason our middle class grew is because we had no competition.
No, she was wrong. The level of exports from the United States after World War II only went up 2 or 3%. It was consequential, but it was not hugely consequential, because the way that we chose to rebuild Europe was not to build to make cement here and take it over and say, we'll build your highway, to make modular buildings here. And it wasn't even to hire American companies like Halliburton and send them over there. Instead, what we did is we gave them the money and we loaned them the money. It was called the Marshall Act. And they built their own factories. They built their own cement factories. They built their own office buildings. Spend some time in Europe and look at the buildings that were built post-World War II. They don't even look American. Different kind of architecture, different kind of construction, different standards, different everything. We did not recover from World War II. The real boost that we got in the early 40s or the late 40s, that was not because we were exporting goods to the rest of the world, or specifically to Japan and Europe. It was because of pent-up demand. It was because Americans for the 4 or 5 years of the war and the time around the war had not been able to buy things. And now they could. And they were having babies like bunnies, and thus the baby boom. And that really fueled the post-World War boom far more than our ability to export things. We were manufacturing things here in the United States for ourselves. You know, textile mills, you know, from the Carolinas to Texas. We were growing our own cotton down in Georgia. We were turning it into our own socks in these mills, and we were selling it to our own growing middle class. And because we had protectionist laws in place that prevented the import of cheap goods from overseas, it was American manufacturers meeting American consumers, and consumer demand arguably was higher in the late 40s than it had ever been in the history of America, other than possibly in the early 1870s after the Civil War.
Gotcha. All right, one last question, and I'm hanging up.
Sure.
Who was our main competition after World War II? Australia? I mean, England? No. Germany,
in terms of exports?
Yeah. Well,
we never had an export based economy. China, Japan, Taiwan, South Korea. They all had export based economies. We have never had an export based economy. Now we have an import based economy, which is arguably bad. But we never, you know, exports were always just around the edges of our economy.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call, Michael. I mean, you know, you can look this stuff up, but the reality is that our exports, at least in the for the first century of America, you know, we did, and in fact, Alexander Hamilton gave specific subsidies to certain industries to produce things for export, particularly cotton and sugar. And as the Industrial Revolution started in the late 19th century, we were exporting some things, but mostly we were building things for America. We had a very, and not just us, every country in the world had basically a very protectionist economy, which is something that came out of King Henry V, King George V. Yeah, I think it was Henry V, which was called the Tudor Plan, which was, you know, raise import taxes, tariffs. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, man, I am watching CNN right now talk about, some Russian website that is saying that it was dead bodies in a plane that was being remotely controlled. Right. I mean, Russia has their Alex Jones, but I doubt that the international press is quoting our Alex Jones. This is that's bizarre. That's bizarre. Jody in Lexington, Kentucky. Hey, Jody, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. This issue of corporate taxes, where the corporations are really ending up not paying anything, we could come up with a system that will protect mom and pops. But this baloney, like you were talking about, of selling to yourself and then basically keeping the money out of the country so that you don't have to pay taxes on it.
Right, while you're making your money on American taxpayers and consumers.
Right, and then foisting off your employee costs basically onto the welfare system.
Right.
That, all that manure's got to go.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's a lousy business model.
We can find a way to protect the mom and pops, but you know, if you want access to the largest, currently largest economy in the world, you're going to pay taxes here.
Yeah. Yeah, it should be. It should be that if you're doing business in the United States, if you're using the U.S. court system, which is more than 50% used by corporations, you should pay taxes to pay for that. You should pay taxes to pay for the roads on which your goods are shipped. You should be paying taxes for the educated workforce that you have. Jody, excellent point. Thank you for the call. Patricia in Sacramento. Hey, Patricia, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Tom, I just wanted to bring up this new story about the Malaysian plane that was downed on the border there, Ukraine and Russia.
Right.
I just want to point out that as when Bush was in power, how as liberals we were skeptical of his foreign policy. But I want to point to just four or five quick facts why I am skeptical of the Obama administration, despite the fact that I'm a progressive liberal. If I look at his trail in the last couple years, if I look at the reporting by Jeremy Scahill, the writer of Dirty Wars,
right.
You know, things like, for example, how Obama increased the private contractors, the use of JSOC to do the targeted assassinations. Obama, more than any other president, has gone after whistleblowers and prosecuted them under the Espionage Act. You know, just the Assad government, that was my one big thing. When he said that it was the Assad government that gassed, that used the sarin gas on his people, then you had Seymour Hersh, who reported that the people in the high levels of the Pentagon were skeptical and that they believed the Obama administration was cherry-picking the intelligence.
Right.
So what I'm trying to say here is, and I'm not trying to demonize Obama, Tom, but I'm just trying to say that we need to be cautious based on the past, based on the lies of Iraq and Afghanistan, based on U.S. policy. You know, we've seen...
Based on the Gulf of Tonkin. I mean, this is nothing new.
Exactly.
Based on the USS Maine.
This is nothing new. Exactly. The fact that we call Iran, you know, a horrible government that suppresses its people, but yet we are friends with Saudi Arabia and we arm them.
Right.
You know, that's my point here is that I don't blame Obama. I just think my concern is I'm finding he's surrounded by warmongers.
I don't think there has ever been a president who is not corrupted by the presidency. I think that there's, you know, and I think part of it is that you have to become a killer. I think it's the, you know, the first time that they walk that guy into the war room and say, see this guy, we need your order to kill him. And suddenly this person who was elected president has blood on his hands and knows it and then has to go out to a cocktail party and smile and shake hands. I think that induces a certain kind of sociopathy. And it's probably true of the leadership of you know, any of the really large countries, but particularly the United States. And,
yeah, and
you know, this is not a hit on Obama either.
Correct. But one last thing I want to point to, if anybody would take a look on YouTube, the Associated Press reporter, Matthew Lee, and some of the other AP journalists who are questioning Psaki, who is a State Department spokesperson, about the Newland, Victoria Newland conversation that was leaked.
Right.
If you just... listen to that. It's just astounding. You can't help but wonder, you know, what is at play here in Ukraine and what is happening with Russia? So
well, go back to November of a year and a half ago and look at the headline that most people don't even know about, the Reuters story that Chevron had cut a $10 billion deal for fracking in Ukraine with the government. I mean, we've got a major oil company. Ukraine is sitting on, it's almost all shale underneath there. It's going to be the Texas of, it's going to be the South Dakota of fracking. It's just going to be insane once they get up to speed. There's a lot at stake here. Patricia, I got to move along. We just have a minute left in the show. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Sorry to hit you with just 1 minute, Paul, but at least last comment.
It's okay. Yeah, I'm not a tax expert, Tom, but, you know, when Gail Trotter was talking about, you know, if we lower the corporate tax rates, all of this corporate money that's would be repatriated for research and all this great stuff. And I thought, well, what are they doing with it now? If it's just sitting doing nothing,
right,
then what makes you think that lowering the corporate tax rate is going to change their minds. I mean, if you want to use your money for something, use it for something. But
right.
to lower it to 25%, they're still going to say, well, it can sit and do nothing if it's as long
right.
as you still have
we've seen this movie before. Do you remember
yeah.
who the last president was to give a tax holiday? Was it Clinton or was it Bush?
Well, I don't know, but
it was either George Herbert Walker Bush or Bill Clinton. They did this, you know, one-time tax holiday where you can repatriate money.
Hey, friends,
and,
Tom Hartman.
And
thanks
I'm
so
getting
much
two audios.
Listening
and all that money came back, and it wasn't used for expanding businesses. It was used for dividends, stockholder dividends, you know, excessive CEO pay, all kinds of absurd things. So it's not the solution. Paul, thanks for the call. It's great to hear from you, as always. We will be back tomorrow. In this beautiful and odd wonderful summer here in Washington, D.C. and around the country. And don't forget that democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require you to show up. There's lots of movement politics groups out there you can participate with. Tag your...
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.